So wait, did you make it to being ship's police?
Oh yes, ship's police. I was in charge. I was one of the. I give us a rank. I slept on deck. My bed was 3 life belts, life jackets, and my pillow was 2 more life jackets. If actually went down, I'd be first over the body side of me. And I had a pretty good trip. But they did some stupid things. They left Liverpool over 100 ships late at night. Next morning, we was on our own. I was flipping alone. We left the destroyers and cruisers and escorts, but we were quite fast. We could do 24, 25 knots. That's quite a good speed. A ship weighing about 22,000 tons. A bit ungainly, but we got. And then I've got a good head for geography. I'm watching the sun, and we're sailing. I'm thinking we're going to North Africa. We're in issue with khaki drill. So you assume you're going, that's the only desert warfare we're in at the moment. So we assume we're going there. But we were going south-southwest, away from Europe. And I thought, I wonder if we're going to the Panama Canal. Surely not, you know. Might be, they might go out as far as we don't know.
Is that because, so they absolutely wouldn't tell you where you were going?
No. Oh, you are joking.
Why? Why wouldn't they say where you're going?
Well, you might tell somebody, or you might get on the radio, perhaps, to talk to another ship.
On the way to
Gibraltar, whatever, you know, and then we'd all die. So, even the crew didn't know where we were going. So the only people actually knew we were going were one of the senior officers. So I'm walking around the ship one day, and I found this door open, something lovely. It's the radio cabin. And I went, I tapped the old microphone, it's live. Nothing we have for the fun here. Atung, Atung, Alaman for us on that ship. See how I look like. The boy said, are you enjoying yourself? Tell me, Captain. I said, yes, I don't know whether to throw you overboard. I put bung in the brig, I'm decided it. They locked me up in the bloody brig for about 3 days. To stir things up. Just when I come out.
So that was a radio that was what, going off to some other ships?
Our radio on the ship. So when everyone on the ship, 4,000 people on that ship, all the crew, all the women, all the married families, and that. At this point, Atung, Alaman, for us on that ship. That's everybody abandoned the ship. Think, and as I spoke, Simon told me, are you enjoying yourself? I went to the say, yes, it's just the captain. I couldn't say it wasn't me, could I?
Caught red handed.
I got away murder in many ways, I say.
So you said that you were looking at the sun to try and figure out which direction.
Yes, and we're going down towards. Well, I thought it was Suez, not Suez, near Panama. And then we turned almost due south. So I started by the way, going around Cape Horn, bottom of South America. And after about 3 or 4 days, must have travelled, so I know how fast the ship was travelling. And I still had quite a good map back of mine. Didn't actually work out. We travelled about 700 miles. That puts us down now. We're not far, almost, must be roughly opposite the Panama Canal. I knew it wasn't exact science, but it was on fire. And then we turned due south, so I thought we were going to go around the Cape. I wonder why we're doing that. And after only about half a day, I turned port, 90 degrees port.
East.
That's right, yeah. And we're sailing now towards Africa. And we're halfway down. You know, the big indent in the side of Africa. We're heading towards that, you know, Dakar and that part, you know. And then we headed south-south-east. So we're going around Johannesburg, Cape of Good Hope. And then over 2 days, and we turned around and went straight north, up to Gibraltar.
We'd be on the side by now.
Yeah, we've been messed up down 7,000 miles. It's supposed to have fallen the enemy. Yeah, we knew where we were going for. We left England. The Fifth Column was very strong in this country during the war. There were a lot of people in this country. We can have Royal Prince, from a very pro-Nazi. And Edward VIII, he was a very strong upholder of the Nazi regime.
What, before the war?
Oh, yes, and in the beginning of the war, too. If he could have done so, he would have gone over there and lived with them. I'm bloody sure he would. He wanted a very good example to our whole family.
So during all this great big cruise then, and all these hundreds of miles at sea, you weren't worried about, were you worried about the U-boats and so on, or were you in a different part of the world for that?
Well, the U-boats were around, but we hadn't got a lot of knowledge of it, quite. You see, that sort of news was kept very limited. It had in the county paper, our ship's been torpedoed, but no one knew that every day 20 or 30 ships were going down, 1,000 men going to their death. It wasn't until the latter part of the war that we got the better of the U-boats by air. That's what beat the U-boats. Not sonar or radar or anything. Air patrols. Because the airplane's flying at 300, 400, 500 miles an hour can come across the submarine on the surface. And before it can dive, it can dive down, drop 2 or 3 bombs, and that's the end of the submarine. And they're not knocking a lot off. Mm. They're knocking off 10 or 20 a week. Mm. That's a lot of submarines. That's what beat the subs. No, but you see, when you're young, last time you might have been torpedoed. I mean, you're a million miles from the rest of the world, aren't you?
We went to
Gibraltar and we got bombed in Gibraltar. The Italians came over and we couldn't see them, it was so high. We knew we could hear them. And we left there, we went to Malta, Valletta Harbour. I had a strange experience there. I'm sitting on the mess deck. And the mess deck, the full width of the ship. And as you get to Valletta Harbour, there's two great pillars by each side of the harbour, and you go between those. And as I'm sitting there, the ship's going that way on that side of the ship, and the other side of the ship going that way. But it was most strange, you know, weird. I'm sitting there, the ship's going here, and that side of the ship is going that way. Well, that's how the ship was going the other way. The ship was turning on its axis. Because to get into Valletta Harbour, it's a very tight squeeze. We had about 6 or 8 foot spare on each side of a 20,000 ton ship to get into Valletta Harbour. And the harbour's full of sunken submarines and merchant ships. And the whole of Malta was flattened. No buildings, everything lived underground.
So that was just a sort of like a refueling point, and you're dropping off supplies. Yeah.
Then we left there, and then we went up to Paris in Greece. Now, in the earlier part of the war, the British army were helping the Greek army to fight the Italians in the basically Greece, and Paris was the main camp. And then the Germans sent in armour. We had no armour. So they send in tanks and armour, you can't fight them with rifles. So we did a Dunkirk. No, is it Dunkirk? A big evacuation? Yeah. I get lost for words sometimes. We did a Dunkirk, picked up. Oh, boy, you should have seen our ship. Every space on there was people sleeping in the lifeboats on the deck everywhere. Every inch there was somebody there. We picked up thousands of people. And we sailed to Alexandria. Got to Alexandria, we got bombed there. Went through the channel, the canal, and somebody said, oh, look, camels. And about 4,000 people rushed to one side of the ship to see the camels, and we ran aground. Now hear this. Oh, you stupid, bloody, dozy bastards. Get below, bloody, these are coming aboard our bloody ship, a bloody lot of you. And that was it. The deck cleared immediately. And they had to get tanks out to dig us out. Come out the end of the Suez Canal, into the Red Sea, the lakes. At the end of the lakes, you're coming into the Indian Ocean. And on the surface, there's a Japanese submarine flying a flag and fired a torpedo at us. But you don't fire torpedoes in broad daylight at the front of a ship. It's still now a target. All the captain did was just went like that, and they're all going, oh, look, there you go, look, wee. I mean, no one seemed very concerned. And they submerged. I went straight back to my bed, got all my life jackets ready, because he went, why is he submerged? Probably what it was, his last torpedo. I don't know, I mean, it's a guess. But if he's submerged, I mean, what's to stop him sinking us? 4,000 or 5,000 people? So I was a bit worried. There was a bit worried there. But I got four or five life jackets. I made bloody sure I wasn't going down with that bloody ship, I tell you. And eventually we got to Bombay. Now, then we came to Bombay Harbour. On the dockside was an elderly lady, 80s and 90s, Salvation Army. And you know the old harmonions? You pedalled them. And she's singing, "Never, my God, to thee." I'll never forget that. It rung out all across the bay. Follow me, what a voice that woman had.
Was she a... Indian lady, or was she English?
No. Oh, I don't know, Ted. I know she had a Salvation Army uniform. I don't know, to be honest, but she had the most beautiful voice and Dick happy.
And yeah, she was welcoming you all.
Oh, yes, she worked on the ship as they came in. I stood on that deck there, and I stood there almost to attention, I think. Never, my God, to thee. I'm not a religious person. And you heard every word. And we got near the edge of the deck with me, applauding and waving and... And that was the gateway to India, right. Bombay.
So that, all in all, that must have taken quite some time, that journey, a few months, presumably.
Oh, yeah, yes. It was, I think, about six and a half weeks, 7 weeks, something like that, yeah.
So you must have been relieved. We came
home in 19 days on the Franconia.
All those years later?
Yeah.
So you must have been very relieved then to get onto terra firma, as they say, then, after those 6.5 weeks, then?
I don't know. I let myself go. When I get into situations, I become part of them. I turn to my advantage. I found the right people to know, the people in charge of canteens and the people in charge of cigarettes and stores. And I came off that ship with about 4 kit bags full of cigarettes.
Which would set you in good stead then for the months to come.
You see, with the English cigarettes are worth double Indian. You can go in India and you buy a packet of bags. It says on it, made by the successors of WH and WHO wheels, but it's made in India, not English. Now I've got 3 kit bags. Flying pontoon. I'm a damn man of pontoon. I was playing on a regular basis with a crew, anybody who play. No, I never play for money. They dodge it because money, you get a lot of money, you know. But cigarettes, well. No.
And they're great for greasing people's palms, of course, aren't they? Yeah. Backsheesh.
Yes. And we got to the harbour. I got all my gear down the gangplank. No one else allowed to go ashore. I was going down to the bows with all the records. The captain never found out why. He pulled me over and said, "Agana, yes, sir. I want you to take all the records down to Calabar Barracks. Go down the gangplank, see the MPs down there. They'll put you right." So I go down there, his MP says, "Right now, you want about 5 rickshaws." So I shout out, "Rickshaw Walla! Paunch, Munter! Paunch, Paunch!" Paunch is 5. Over they come, 5 of them. All loaded up.
And these are the records, what sort of documents about the journey?
All troops are landing, yes. And landing to go to Calabar Barracks. Now you say to the headman, well, appears to be the leader of this group of rickshaw wallahs, "Tum Malum Calabar Barracks." If he says nay, don't get on a rickshaw. If he says particularly, yes. And then you say, I got caught, then you often get caught. Guilty, guilty, guilty. So I get on the rickshaw and off we go. This rickshaw is doing about 40 miles an hour. It's a man running. But have you ever seen an ostrich run?
Hmm.
Each pace is about 30 or 40 or 50 feet. Thus is the fastest creature on 2 legs. Nothing can catch an ostrich. They can run about 50, 60 miles an hour. Mm. And we're going down through Bombay, which is like Rome. It's on hills. We've got no brakes. We're going through red lights. They're over crossings. And Bombay is full of elephants, bullocks, buffalo, camels, every known creature, every form of transport, London buses, London taxis, yellow cabs, all day, I tell you. You wouldn't believe it. Kamaj is the place to go.
Well,
that was really something. Mm-hmm. Right up in North India. So we get to, got to our camp. BBRC, British Base Reinforcement Camp. Four million men assembled in one place. The biggest assembly of armed men ever in history. There are five camps. Camp 1, Camp 2, and each camp I already know nearly a million men. And I'm wandering around. I'm going to black my nose, aren't I? I'm wandering around. And I bump into a school friend from Colts. He's with the second Leicesters. Oh, I suppose I'm meeting you. Went out a few beers. I'm in 4 million men. 8,000, 10,000 miles from home. I bump into a schoolmate I haven't seen for, well, since I left school.
So were you still, at this stage, were you still in charge of all these records, or was that...
No, they've been delivered. I moved on since then, yes.
Yeah.
I'm now finding my feet.
So did you? So were you able to spend a bit of time with this school friend then, or were you forced
no,
into...
No, no matter of how long. I mean, we had a few beers, but then he had to disappear. Never ever saw him again. I don't know what happened to him. I don't even know if he survived the war or not. I don't know. But then I started, see what's going on in Bombay. Mm. Interesting.
Do you want a glass of water or anything, Arthur? If you're...
No, I'll go a drink then.
Oh, okay.
Just use your toilet.
That's all right, there, sir.
Okay, yeah, can I use your toilet? Okay. Can I use your toilet?
Yes. The
door.
Carry
on if you like.
Turn right, turn left, turn right.
Sorry, excuse me about that. It's so warm in here. It's so warm and cosy.
Oh.
I'm falling asleep a bit, so I'm
going to
wash my face. Excuse me.
So, yeah, turn right.
Lovely.
Then turn left, then turn right.
Lovely, thank you.
The light's marked with the door.
Yes.
Yeah. So I spent two or three weeks avoiding all the officers. And then, feeling the feet.
Mm. But presumably, though, in these sorts of situations, you've been, you're part of your regiment, your battalion. You've got, or even though you obviously are finding your feet, there's ostensibly things going on, plans being made.
And somebody must have found out that I had but I was quite well educated, which I was. I was quite posh in voice and manner. I could have passed an officer quite easily. Mm. And if an officer knew on me, you wouldn't have said, no, officer. Mm. I could have passed a major, maybe anybody. Because, when you go to a private school, you're taught to show yourself for the best. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's to come back to what you were saying there about, when you're in the camp and so on, and I imagine, I think it's one of those things, isn't it, where... There might be antipathy from some sorts of people, but as long as you don't, as long as you are respectful of people, background, and you don't patronise them, then people will actually they'll overcome their hostility to what they see as one of the snooty ones.
And someone must have told one of some of these officers, senior officers, that there was a fella in the gunners lot, not very respectful about it, and in the gunners lot, that. The bigger they might be injured. Bigger they're looking for a bodyguard and driver. I knew they're better, of course, obviously not. And after a lot of haggling, it's all done very... what's the word I want? All done what appeared to be underhand. It wasn't that open. It was all very, very secretive. I moved here, I moved to a nice building, but I moved to a nice hotel. I got all new gear. I still a gun though, but it was nice quality gun, material, quite smart. Quite like this, and because we had servants. India is a nation of servants. Mm. And I teamed up with this fella, Brigadier Chater. He was he was fighting the First World War. He'd have fought this war on horseback with a cavalry sword, he would if he had let him.
So he wasn't really well adapted to what was going on.
Really. But he was a staff officer. Now, do you know what a staff officer is?
I'm not all that clear. I mean,
I don't know. I'm not trying to catch you out, because sometimes I'm quite amazed how much people do know. Mm. So I'm not trying to belittle you like that. How do you tell a staff officer? Well, his epaulets are red. When he's got red epaulets, he's a staff officer. That means they're fully paid up, whatever bank is on his shoulder. Now, I'm in battle, and all my officers get killed. I'm a second lieutenant, one pipper. I'm now in charge of the regiment. We are also dead. So now I assume the rank of colonel or whatever. I have a colonel's badge and I'm wearing a uniform. I don't get paid a colonel. I'm still paid as a gunner. Okay? Like my bathroom?
I love your bathroom. It's so warm and cosy. Please forgive me, it's too cosy.
Yes, all right. So I then teamed up with this brigadier. And through being with the brigadier, I met... who's the bloke got murdered by the IRA?
Mountbatten.
He was the Governor General from India, the last one. I met him on several occasions. When they dropped the atom bomb at the end of the war, I was among the first few people in the world, I should imagine. I went to an officer's meeting. I think, where was it now? Somewhere in northern India. I dropped the first atom bomb. And I went there because I was the brigadier's driver. And so where V went, I went. V went out with a lady friend. I followed him everywhere. Yeah, the night I spent there, I slept outside his room with a gun under my pillow. It's never out of my sight, never. That's my job. And my job is to lay my life down necessary to save his life. And he's a nutcase, but he's a nice fella. I liked him. I said to him, you're nuttier than I am, and that's saying something, I'll tell you. This is the brigadier. You don't talk to brigadiers like that, I'll tell you. Another officer heard me that, I've been shot, hung, drawn, and quartered. And I'm a bit saucy. And I find you a bit saucy. You often get away. I'm not too rude. I'm not too down-putting. I just said now there, do you want to make call certain thing? And a staff officer. How do you recognise a staff officer? An army staff officer, he has red epaulettes on his uniform. That means he's a fully paid up rank, whatever's on his shoulder. And I was standing there. If I was in battle and I was a one pipper and all the officers were killed, I'd assume rank of colonel. I'd wear a colonel's uniform, I'd wear his rank, but I only get paid as a gunner.
As opposed to a staff officer, is that right?
Yeah, staff officer. I can't downgrade him. I don't know what he earned. He used to say to me sometime, "You got any cigarettes, Arthur?" I said, "You don't smoke, sir. For you, go and have a store. Get 1,000. I could have a store there. Go in there, sign there, come out 1,000 players. I was smoking 80 a day. But I used a cigarette holder. And in the army, I was known as the Count, the Duke, the Baron, all sorts of, flattering names.
But sorry, you said that's what they called you. That was your nickname?
Oh, yeah.
Because you used a cigarette holder?
Well, you see in the picture, isn't it? My lady friend had been dining out with a cigarette holder and a five-star motel.
I think you did show me, actually. But, yeah. We're going to have another look at those at some point.
And so you get known. And as you get known by other officers, they're not quite so quick to ignore you. Because you've got the ear of the brigadier. Now, the brigadier is only one rank below general. Now I see your eyes flicker a little bit. One rank below general. That's high. I was field marshals and CIGS and goodness knows what else, but the highest rank in the army normally is a general, other than a field marshal. And my brigadier was only one rank below a general. That makes me a pretty high officer, I'll tell you. A much respected one. From the First World War, of course. And when they dropped the first bomb on Japan, I don't know where it was. I went to a place I didn't know. I wasn't even told where I was with my brigadier. Went into a very big room and the Lord
Mountbatten
was there and all the top rank, all the brigadiers, the field marshal, all the big noises. We sat down there, round table there. I sat at the back, of course, keeping an eye on things. And it showed the plane going in. The old plane was photographing it when I woke up and saw the bomb go off.
Oh, right, so they were showing the film footage.
The very first picture of the first atom bomb being exploded.
So was it a film or was it a photograph?
Oh, no, film. Oh,
yeah, yeah, they filmed it.
Because there was another plane accompanying the...
Yes.
Another game. Yes, yes. Another game, yeah. Well, no, I couldn't remember that. Mm. Yeah. And they dropped the first bomb. But the Japanese said it couldn't possibly be a bomb. It must have been a meteorite or a satellite or... it couldn't possibly be a bomb.
Because no one had experienced it before.
No. So he dropped the second one on Hiroshima. Was Hiroshima first or second? Yeah.
Oh, if it was first.
Yeah. No, I think it's Hiroshima first and then Nagasaki.
On Nagasaki. And they agreed it must have been a bomb.
Oh, just to prove the point, they dropped the second one.
And then Hirohito surrendered to Mountbatten. But, you know, Japanese people... I was in the vanguard to invade Japan. I was actually lined up to be... I'd been the first to go in. Now, in Japan, if we'd invaded Japan, everybody that could breathe or eat would have fought us. Kids, everybody. Dogs and bloody cats and all, probably. They'd all die to kill us. They'd have been running towards us to get killed. Because they wouldn't kill you. It would have been something. When I was in a hospital called Jalahari. That's in southern India. It's the biggest hospital ever in the world. It could accommodate over 1 million casualties. That's what I expected for our invasion of Japan. And because it wasn't used, we were living there. Jalahari East, Jalahari West. It was... not far from Bangalore. Bangalore is an officer station. And I only lived in officer stations. I went out north to
Assam? Simla? No.
Up in northern India, northwest of India, there are some huge areas, whole counties, where all the teas are grown. And they were hill stations for the officers. And they got there in hot weather. When it gets up in 140 in the shade... We were doing drill, 140 in shade, look now. You're only allowed to stay in look now for 6 months. After 6 months, you're dead. I've been in the house in look now, which had was attacked by the Indian mutiny. This house, very big house, a beautiful house, it must have belonged to somebody at title. They held off about 20 or 30,000 Indian revolutionaries. They're mostly civilians. They held out for months. The story is that some woman once said one day, "Relief is coming. I can hear the bagpipes." I can't hear nothing. And that 3 days later, the Gordon Highlands came in. When she did hear him, I don't know. It is possible. People do sometimes have this rather strange. I never poo-poo it. I've met too many people who can do these sort of things. I've met quite a few holy men. They're fascinating.
Satus or
whatever. Near one of my camps, the holy man seems to be up there. He goes, "Oh, I'm up in the air. It's been up there for 30 years. He couldn't begin now if he wanted to. And he never wouldn't accept any money. All he ever accept was a little bit of food, enough to keep him going each day, and occasionally a change of clothing. But he used to give spiritual help to the local people. And he was a very educated man. He spoke English, beautiful English. There'd been Oxford or Cambridge. I nearly married a princess. Unbeknown. You see, it's where you tread wary. I'm going to these palaces and all the Maharajas, Rajas. They've got some weird names, some of them, Ranis and Sultanas and Sultans, whatever. And I went there and this fellow says to me, what amazed me was all these high-ranking officials all spoke very good English. I spoke better English because I'd had education lessons at school, and we prided ourselves on our King's English. Oh, yeah, that's very important. So we'd gone on very well, these people. They respected me because I spoke as well as they did. I didn't like very much the common down to a soldier, but I could speak to him in fact, and I also spoke a bit of French, German. I still speak quite a bit of several languages. None very fluently now, so I've lost a lot of it. But I know, say how I love you in about 30 languages. Yeah, true.
I won't ask you how that came to be.
Yeah.
And I was about to swear in about 15 languages. Because you pick them out as you go along, you know, you go along. You go into a camp, a Greek camp or Egyptian camp, whatever it might be, and travels. And he says, "What did he say?" Very rude. "What was it?" And he said, oh dear. "What was it?" I'm trying to remember that.
Is that how you got to learn a lot of the language? Yes, just literally just...
And I looked after the German prisoner of war before I went overseas. And I said, listen, then, because if I ever plan to escape, and I know what I'm saying, I'm warned, aren't I?